All right, so are you ready to dive into a case that really makes you think twice about the Sixth Amendment?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is a fascinating one.
It's the story of United States v. Feldman and Martinson, a Seventh Circuit decision. And it really shows just how tricky things can get when civil depositions and criminal trials collide. We've got excerpts from the case itself, legal briefs, and even a podcasting guide,
Oh, wow.
which, as always, we'll be setting aside.
Of course.
So, are you ready to unpack this?
Yeah, let's get to it. This case is really a great illustration of how important it is to protect the right to confront your accuser, especially when evidence from a civil case is being used in a criminal trial.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so picture this.
Yeah.
First Guaranty Metals, FGM. They're selling these leveraged precious metals contracts, high-risk investments, big promises.
Right.
And as you might have guessed, it all goes south.
Yeah.
Customer losses, investigations by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the whole nine yards.
The whole nine yards. And at the center of all this are Richard Feldman and Richard Martinson. Feldman was an owner of FGM, and Martinson was involved in various capacities, sometimes a partner, sometimes a trader, sometimes a consultant. The government claimed they defrauded over 1,000 FGM customers,
Yeah.
leading to losses of over $11
A
million.
lot of people and a lot of money. So, what exactly were they accused of doing?
Well, the indictment alleged that they made false statements
Okay.
about FGM's hedging practices, how their prices were set, and how easy it was for customers to get their money out. Essentially, classic financial fraud
Yeah,
allegations.
it sounds like it. So, it sounds like a pretty straightforward case so far. Where does it get more complicated?
Here's where it gets interesting. Enter Herbert Sandberg,
Okay.
former president of FGM.
Got it.
He gives a deposition in the CFTC's civil case against the company. Seems routine, right?
Yeah, you would think
Except
so.
Sandberg had a secret deal with prosecutors in the criminal investigation.
Oh, wow.
He had immunity.
So he's spilling the beans about FGM, but he has a get out of jail free card in his pocket, and the defendants have no idea. That doesn't sound right.
Exactly. And it gets even more complicated. Feldman and Martinson weren't even present at Sandberg's deposition, so they had no opportunity to challenge his statements or even know what he was saying about them.
That seems like a major violation of their Sixth Amendment right to confront their accuser.
You're getting to the heart of the matter. That's exactly what the Seventh Circuit thought, too. Now, fast forward to the first trial in 1981. Sandberg's deposition, with all its baggage, gets used as evidence. And guess what?
I'm guessing it didn't go well for Feldman and Martinson.
You're right. Based largely on Sandberg's testimony, they're convicted on multiple counts of mail and wire fraud. Each gets hit with a 12-year prison sentence
Wow.
and a $38,000 fine.
12 years, based on a deposition where they couldn't even cross-examine the witness. Something seems off about that.
And that's exactly what the Seventh Circuit thought. Feldman and Martinson appealed, and the court overturned the convictions. They cited two major errors. One was allowing Sandberg's deposition as evidence, and the other was a violation of the Speedy Trial Act.
Okay, so let's unpack those errors,
Sure.
starting with the deposition. What was the court's reasoning for calling that a Sixth Amendment violation?
Well, the court emphasized that the right to cross-examination isn't just about asking questions.
Right.
It's about having a meaningful opportunity to challenge the witness. In this case, the defendants were in the dark about Sandberg's immunity deal, and they couldn't effectively probe his motives or credibility.
So even if they had been at the deposition, it wouldn't have been a fair fight because they didn't have all the information.
Exactly. The court was very clear that a naked opportunity to cross-examine without the context of the immunity deal just doesn't cut it.
Right.
It's like going into a boxing match with one hand tied behind your back. You're not going to have a fair chance.
And to make matters worse, they weren't even in the ring to begin with because they weren't at the deposition.
Right. They had no idea what punches were being thrown, let alone how to defend themselves. The court recognized that this undermined the whole idea of a fair trial. And this brings us to the second point they made, which is conflicting motives. The goals in the civil case brought by the CFTC and the criminal fraud charges were fundamentally different.
Okay, so help me understand that. Why did the different motives matter?
Well, in the civil case, the CFTC was focused on financial liability,
Huh.
like who lost money and how to recover it. Feldman and Martinson had no reason to think they were staring down criminal charges at that point.
So their strategy in the civil case was probably just trying to minimize their financial exposure. not defending themselves against accusations that could land them in prison.
Exactly. They might not have gone after Sandberg's statements as aggressively if they didn't think those statements would impact their potential financial liability. They weren't playing the same game, so their defense strategy was totally different.
This makes it even clearer how unfair it was to use that deposition against them in a criminal trial. It's like taking a soundbite from a casual conversation and twisting it to make it sound incriminating in a completely different context.
That's a great analogy. The context is everything, and the Seventh Circuit recognized that. They explicitly stated that Feldman and Martinson had no reason to suspect that Sandberg would incriminate them on criminal charges.
It sounds like the court was saying, you can't just take evidence from a civil case where the stakes were totally different and use it against someone in a criminal trial. It's a huge win for protecting defendants' rights, and it throws a real wrench into some prosecutorial strategies.
Absolutely. The government can't just assume that civil evidence is fair game in a criminal case. They have to prove that the defendants' rights were protected, especially the right to confront their accusers.
So we've covered the deposition issue, but you mentioned another key factor in the Seventh Circuit's decision, the Speedy Trial Act violation.
Right.
Tell me more about that.
Okay, so the Speedy Trial Act is this really important piece of legislation, and it's designed to prevent defendants from languishing in legal limbo while they wait for their day in court. It sets specific deadlines for different stages of a federal criminal case. One crucial rule is that the trial must begin within 70 days of either the indictment or the defendant's first appearance in court, whichever is later.
70 days seems pretty reasonable. Where did things go wrong in this case?
Well, the initial indictment might have fallen within those time frames, but things took a turn when a superseding indictment was filed.
Okay.
It added a whole new charge to the mix. Racketeering, often called RICO.
RICO, yeah. Doesn't that charge often come up in cases involving organized crime?
You're right. It often does. In this case, it's not about traditional organized crime. But the point is that adding this new charge wasn't just like a minor edit.
Right.
You know, it significantly raised the stakes.
I see what you mean. So why would adding a new charge reset the clock on the Speedy Trial Act?
Well, a superseding indictment can drastically change the complexity of a case.
Yeah.
Imagine preparing for a misdemeanor trial and then all of a sudden finding out you're facing felony charges.
Yeah.
That's essentially what happened to Feldman and Martinson. They needed time to adjust their defense strategy.
So the Speedy Trial Act isn't just about speed for the sake of speed. It's also about ensuring defendants have adequate time to prepare for the specific charges against them.
Exactly. The Seventh Circuit ruled that adding the RICO charge was a major shift. And the 70-day clock should have restarted when that superseding indictment was filed.
So in this instance, the government's desire for a quick trial actually backfired.
Yeah, the trial began before the defendants had a fair chance to prepare for that new, more complex charge. It violated their right to a speedy trial, as guaranteed by the Speedy Trial Act. The Seventh Circuit saw that as a major error.
It sounds like the Seventh Circuit was really emphasizing the importance of due process in this case. They weren't willing to let procedural shortcuts undermine the defendant's right to a fair trial.
Absolutely. They sent a clear message that the government can't just rush a case to trial, even when pursuing serious charges like financial fraud. The right to a speedy trial isn't just a suggestion, it's a cornerstone of our justice system.
This case really highlights the importance of balancing speed and fairness in the legal system. It's not just about getting to a verdict quickly, but about ensuring that the process itself is just.
That's a great way to put it. And for our lawyer and law student listeners out there, Feldman and Martinson is a good reminder to pay close attention to those Speedy Trial Act deadlines. Knowing how and when those deadlines apply can make a huge difference in the outcome of a case.
Okay, so we've explored both major errors that led to the convictions being overturned, using the deposition and the Speedy Trial Act violation. It seems like there's a common thread running through both those issues.
What do you see as the common thread? What do you see as the common thread?
Well, in both instances, it seems like the court was really concerned about protecting the defendant's right to a fair trial. You know, they weren't willing to let the government cut corners or sacrifice due process, even in a complex case like this involving some pretty serious, you know, financial fraud allegations.
That's a sharp observation.
Yeah.
The Seventh Circuit's decision in Feldman and Martinson really emphasizes that fundamental principle. You know, a fair trial trumps expediency. It's a reminder that justice isn't just about reaching a verdict. It's about ensuring that the process itself is fair and impartial.
Yeah, this case really makes you think about the delicate balance between pursuing justice and protecting individual rights. Sometimes it seems like those two goals can be in tension with each other.
Yeah, it's a constant challenge. And this case is a great example of how courts grapple with those competing interests. On the one hand, you want to hold people accountable for their actions, especially when those actions have caused, significant harm to others. But you also don't want to trample on fundamental rights in the process.
It's easy to get caught up in the emotional aspects of a case, especially one involving financial fraud with so many victims. But the courts have to stay focused on the legal principles at stake.
Absolutely. And that's what the Seventh Circuit did here. They didn't let the complexity of the case or the severity of the allegations distract them from their core mission, upholding a constitution and ensuring a fair trial for the defendants.
It's a powerful reminder that everyone, even those accused of serious crimes, deserves a fair shake in court.
Couldn't agree more. And for our lawyer and law student listeners out there, Feldman and Martinson offer some valuable takeaways. It highlights the potential pitfalls of using civil evidence in criminal cases, and it underscores the importance of really scrutinizing those depositions carefully.
And of course, it's a good reminder to keep those Speedy Trial Act deadlines front of mind.
Exactly. Those timelines aren't just suggestions. They're enforceable rights that can have a real impact on the outcome of a case.
So we've reached the end of our deep dive into United States. So, V. Feldman and Martinson, it's been a winding journey through some legal twists and turns. But I think we've uncovered some really important principles about the Sixth Amendment, the right to a speedy trial, and the importance of due process in our justice system.
It's been a pleasure exploring this case with you, and I think it's a reminder that the law is more than just a set of rules. It's a living, breathing system that constantly evolves as we grapple with new challenges and try to ensure justice for everyone involved.
Well said. And for our listeners, we hope this deep dive has sparked some new insights and perhaps even inspired you to do some exploring of your own. The world of law is full of fascinating cases and thorny legal questions. So keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.
What do you see as the common thread?
Well, in both instances, it seems like the court was really concerned about protecting the defendant's right to a fair trial. They weren't willing to let the government cut corners or sacrifice due process, even in a complex case like this, involving some pretty serious financial fraud allegations.
That's a really sharp observation.
Yeah, the Seventh Circuit's decision in United States v. Feldman and Martinson really emphasizes that fundamental principle: a fair trial trumps expediency. It's a reminder that justice isn't just about reaching a verdict. It's about ensuring that the process itself is fair and impartial.
This case really makes you think about that delicate balance, between pursuing justice and protecting individual rights. Sometimes it seems like those two goals can be in tension with each other. It's a constant challenge, and this case is a great example of how courts grapple with those competing interests. On the one hand, you want to hold people accountable for their actions, especially when those actions have caused, significant harm to others, but you also don't want to trample on fundamental rights in the process.
It's easy to get caught up in the emotional aspects of a case, especially one involving financial fraud with so many victims. But the courts have to stay focused on the legal principles at stake.
Absolutely. And that's what the Seventh Circuit did here. They didn't let the complexity of the case or the severity of the allegations distract them from their core mission, upholding the Constitution and ensuring a fair trial for the defendants.
It's a powerful reminder that everyone, even those accused of serious crimes, deserves a fair shake in court.
I couldn't agree more. And for our lawyer and law student listeners, Feldman and Martinson offer some valuable takeaways. It highlights the potential pitfalls of using civil evidence in criminal cases and underscores the importance of scrutinizing those depositions very carefully.
And of course, it's a good reminder to keep those Speedy Trial Act deadlines front of mind.
Exactly. Those timelines aren't just suggestions. They're enforceable rights, and they can have a real impact on the outcome of a case.
So we've reached the end of our deep dive into United States v. Feldman and Martinson. It's been a winding journey through legal twists and turns, but I think we've uncovered some really important principles about the Sixth Amendment, the right to a speedy trial, and the importance of due process in our justice system.
It's been a pleasure exploring this case with you, and I think it's a reminder that the law is more than just a set of rules. It's a living, breathing system that constantly evolves as we grapple with new challenges and try to ensure justice for everyone involved.
Well said. And for our listeners, we hope this deep dive has sparked some new insights and perhaps even inspired you to do some exploring of your own. The world of law is full of fascinating cases and thorny legal questions, so keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.